Good music is what we want to hear.
What do you mean, good music?
It's what we dance to, what our children will dance to. And if you don't want to play it, then take your records and go home.
Did you have a band? Good or bad?
It's a great band. It's a bad band. It's like pizza, baby. It's good no matter what. There's music in the air.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, a pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kotz. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, the Rock Doctors are back. Once again, an ailing music lover has found her way to us, and we're going to put her on the road to recovery.
Plus, we'll talk about the new albums from The Shins, John Mellencamp, and The Good, The Bad, and The Queen.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
Dedication to
you, yeah.
For those not with us no more.
Well, let me reach down in my bag.
We dedicate this to them.
Get you what you're looking for.
That crack.
My name Wayne, and I came to party. My watch are icy, and my chain are frosty. But to speak like me, but they mains are salty. I ain't on strike three, but his brains are cost me.
Greg, we're listening to a mixtape by an artist known as DJ Drama. With Lil Wayne on there. It was called Dedication 2. Poor DJ Drama. His real name is Tyree Simmons. You've probably heard about this. A little more than a week ago, 10 days ago, the law enforcement officers of Atlanta, Georgia, descended en masse as if they were, in a SWAT team on the studio that DJ Drama works out of, downtown Atlanta, seized 81,000 CDs, four vehicles, recording gear, and, quote, other assets that are proceeds of a pattern of illegal activity. Mind you, we're not talking drug paraphernalia. It's all about producing CDs that are sold on the street, in some cases through some reputable retailers. They're prosecuting DJ Drama, or intend to, under the RICO laws, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization laws, which were established to stop the mafia. What is this guy doing? He's making CDs. That's all he's doing. What the heck's going on?
The record industry is in a really, really strange area right now, Jim, because it's essentially saying that for years it had turned its back on these mixed CDs, saying that they're in some ways a good thing because they've been using them as a promotional tool. Now they are treating mixtapes, it appears, after this raid, as counterfeit. In other words, they're putting them on the same plane as the backroom guy who gets a copy of Jay-Z's Black Album and runs off 1,000 copies of it and runs out on the street corner and sells them for $10 a piece. You know, Jay-Z's Black Album. Right. Here it is. It's a counterfeit copy. He's making all the profit on it, and the record industry doesn't like that. They've been shutting those guys down, or trying to, for decades. It could be argued that artists like 50 Cent, Kanye West, Clips, Lupe Fiasco would not be who they are were it not for this mixtape culture. DJs like DJ Drama, DJ Clue, DJ K-Slay, these people have been the go-to guys for a kind of a shady but nonetheless very lucrative side business for the music industry. In other words, the music industry understands that these guys aren't exactly performing legitimately, quote-unquote, but they are actually helping the major label releases of these artists by promoting the songs that are going to come out on them, promoting the artists that are going to appear on them, and creating a buzz, building a buzz, building a promotional campaign for a major label record. So for years, the major labels have been saying, essentially, they're fine with this. They're not going to shut these people down. But this raid now indicates that they're changing their strategy. They're wondering, hey, we want a piece of this money as well. And it looks like the mixed CD culture in America is in big, big trouble.
Not making a lot of sense to me. Maybe we can get some perspective on it from Jeff Chang, our colleague in Berkeley, California. He's a fellow critic, fellow journalist, author of the definitive hip-hop history, Can't Stop, Won't Stop. Jeff, is this making any sense to you?
Well, I think, the reason that there's such a huge uproar in the hip-hop community right now is that rather than attacking distributors or retailers, it seems now that the RIAA has crossed the line into trying to go after artists. And, the mixtape thing is a really interesting industry, sort of sub-industry in and of itself.
Let's start with that most basic question,
okay.
Jeff, because if you hear the RIAA describe what a mixtape is, it sounds different from hearing what people in the hip-hop world. First of all, there's no tape involved.
Right.
These are CDs, homemade CDs that are being sold. What is a mixtape?
A mix CD is basically, or a mixtape is something that's put together by a select, now kind of an elite group of DJs that will include a lot of exclusive, what they call exclusives, or brand new songs or previews from established artists.
Well, and in some cases, let's cite two examples. Recently, The Clips was, you know, is a hip hop duo that they had a lot of buzz, but then they had label problems. It was years before their recent album came out. Lupe Fiasco was signed to a label quite some time ago. His debut album was 3-4 years in the making. In both cases, they kept their name in the hip hop world by releasing songs to DJs who put them on mixtapes, right?
Exactly.
Okay, but the catch here is that I'm signed to a record label, so the label owns that song.
That's
right. So even if I'm willingly releasing it to the compiler of a mixtape, I don't really have the right to do that.
Well, and let's complicate it further, because a lot of times what will happen is you've got your A&R person who is sympathetic to the artist and does want to keep the buzz going because they know that they're going to have to, you know, play the game and keep their artist's name out there. And so a lot of times you'll get money, promotional money, set aside in the artist's budget to pay for mixtape making. You know, and so there's where the line gets extremely, extremely blurry.
Well, it's blurry also, too, Jeff, I think, because we're talking about not just underground, unknown acts who are on this. As you've said, there are some bigger names, and it's almost behooves even the biggest name artists, the Jay-Z's and the 50 Cent's and the Eminem's and the Kanye West's. I mean, I've got, on my shelf, I've got 4 or 5 Kanye West mix CDs, none of which were authorized by his record company. But in the past, the record labels have looked the other way because they know this is a way to build publicity, way to build buzz, way to promote an artist before his real, quote-unquote, record comes out. Now it appears with this raid that the record industry is taking a different stance on these mix CDs.
That's right. And my theory actually has to do with the fact that mixtapes have gone mainstream in the past 2 years, and not so coincidentally to many record label executives, it coincides with the toughest years that hip-hop and rap has had probably since the 80s. And so they start looking at this and they start going, wait a minute, we're getting these mixtapes out, these artists are going out, they're selling this type of stuff, we don't control that money stream, how do we get back in control of that? How do we take that money out? You know, what you have these days is record companies trying to figure out how they can take more of the artist's output.
Aren't they sort of defeating the whole idea behind it, though? Isn't the whole idea that it can work quickly, it does work between the margins, the fact that there is sort of an air of not quite legitimacy about it, there's an outlaw nature to it. Once they co-opt it, once they say, let's bring some of this income into our house, aren't in effect they're creating another outlaw culture out there that's saying, no, wait a minute, we're not going to play that game, we're going to do something else outside the margins?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it appears that what they're going to be doing is, again, sort of figuring out other ways to choke the goose.
Yeah.
You know, and they're basically trying to figure out ways that they can control all of this stuff. And in the end, you know, the question is it going to come back and bite them?
We're looking at this, too, in terms of, do you have a sense of which of the major labels are condoning this raid and which aren't? I mean, do you have a sense that is this sort of like a new – was there some backdoor meeting a few weeks ago where all the labels got together and said, wait a minute, let's address this? Or
people got to understand, Greg, what the RIAA is. It's like, you know, you know the mafia movies when the heads of the five families gather around the conference table and they decide what's good for business – you know, for everybody.
Right.
So it's the umbrella organization of all of the major labels. I guess what we're wondering, Jeff, is there, you know, it's good for some labels. Some labels have seen this do good business for them, priming the pump for an act. Is everybody, all the major labels, against this, or are there some that are split?
You know, I imagine that there's been a lot of back and forth and conversations that have been going on within the industry about mixtapes for quite a long time on all of this stuff.
Well, and also just because one part of one company approves of something doesn't mean the whole thing doesn't. The classic example, you know, Sony will sell you the CD or DVD burner to burn illegal copies at the same time that Sony, the product distributor, is trying to get you not to burn their CDs and DVDs.
Absolutely. And that's the whole, you know, irony of this monopoly structure is basically a lot of these folks that are making these decisions really don't understand what it is that they're in business to do.
Well, thanks as always. Jeff Chang is a hip-hop historian, author, colleague of ours. Many props up there in Berkeley, Jeff.
Thanks so much.
For the record, we reached out to the Recording Industry Association of America to ask them to provide an interview. Not only would they not come on the air with us, Greg, they wouldn't even give us a statement specifically about their problem with mixtapes.
Well, I can stand beside ideals I think are right. And I can stand beside the idea to stand and fight. I do believe there's a dream for everyone. This is our country.
Oh, man, if you have watched television at all in the last couple of months, you have no doubt seen a commercial that uses that song on the soundtrack. The song is Our Country by John, no longer Cougar, Mellencamp. You know, it's supposed to work, Greg, that we're unable to talk about the song without talking about the manufacturer of the line of cars and trucks. I refuse to mention them. The car commercial shows uplifting images of American history. Immigrants at the Statue of Liberty. Welcome, America. I'm here. Along with some distinctly darker episodes. Vietnam. Watergate. All leading up, according to the reports I read in the advertising press, you know, they wanted a distinctly American voice, and they wanted to show that America has had its ups and downs, but like a trusty vehicle from the company I will not mention, nothing can ultimately stop it. It just keeps rolling around and guzzling gas and making us reliant on oil from the Middle East. But regardless, they choose for their spokesong person, John Mellencamp.
Yeah, Mellencamp, who has famously spoken out against TV ads or any kind of using his songs in any kind of advertising for decades, makes this quite a significant turnaround.
Mocked by name, Bob Seger, who previously sold a song to the same company I will not mention.
Oh, yes.
Made fun of the guy.
I interviewed Mellencamp in 97, and I was asking him about this. And his quote was, "It just steals from your integrity. I feel terrible when I see that happening." And he was mocking Bob Dylan then, because Dylan's music had just started to surface on television advertising. Now, a few months ago, in explaining this walk-up to his new album with the first single being released as a television commercial as opposed to a radio single, "If I can get my songs on television in front of people, that's what I'm going to do." At this point, for guys like myself, it's about survival.
He went even further in Vanity Fair in a story and said that this company that will not be named has been a better record label to me than Columbia Records.
Right.
I think, Greg, the heartbreaking thing here is that, you know, look, Mellencamp is not a serious artist like Bob Seger. I mean, he's a meat and potatoes rocker, and he's had moments of greatness, and he's had moments of sheer and utter Little Pink Houses kind of kitsch, okay? But he's generally been sincere. You know, and the last album he made, in particular, was, I thought, probably the most mature album of his career. It was called Trouble No More, came out in 2003. Mm-hmm. Johnny, formerly Cougar, was upset. He's watching America's freedoms erode in the wake of 9/11. He's watching the war in Iraq. He thinks it's unjust. His response was to go back to the 30s and 40s and cover folk and blues songs.
Mm-hmm.
A really credible album, which didn't sell at all.
Right. Well, that's been part of the problem here. And, you know, I think you do Mellencamp a slight disservice in saying that he's not a serious artist. I think, the sound that he created in the 80s was very much copied. He did an interesting thing where he was merging rustic folk instruments, dobros and fiddles and things like that, with that big drum sound, a la Gasoline Alley, the Rod Stewart early 70s kind of records. So in
terms, I don't know if that's a sign of that it was good.
But his bands were always really well respected, and he always put on a very, very credible live show. And,
the man ain't Bob Dylan.
Nobody is, though.
Okay.
But speaking of Dylan, he was one of those artists that did sell his music to commercials. Mellencamp was one of the few, including Tom Petty, Tom Waits, Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, who basically took a stand and saying, this is the wrong thing to do. You know, we shouldn't be selling our music to advertising. It cheapens the money. It cheapens the impact of the song that we wrote. Does that mean the song we wrote is now going to be associated with this product forever instead of what we originally intended it for?
Greg, it's impossible. We're talking about this album up in the news because there is this news peg, and it once again is making everybody wonder if selling out is anything that is even still a valid concept today, but let's try to separate all that now, having talked about that, and listen to the album as art. It's called Freedom's Road, just came out. I think that this is a track that epitomizes the entire album. It is once again a concept album. It is once again a Shadow of 9/11, middle of the Iraq War album. This song, The Americans, I think kind of is typical. We'll be right back.
from the Midwest.
I try to understand all the cultures of this world.
And actually, believe it or not, it gets worse from there. He's flying over the country in my airplane. He's driving down the highways. He's bemoaning the ghost towns. He's singing with Joan Baez. Get this. Mellencamp wants you to know the Jim Crow laws were bad.
Yeah, and you know what? They're still around. I mean,
there's
what
a song
there's
called
a,
Jim Crow
yeah,
there.
Jim
racism,
Crow never went away. Yeah, racism is still bad, Jim.
Not good.
Yeah.
Now, look, I caught some crap in some corners for championing Neil Young's Living with War. Some people said, look, this is too obvious. And indeed, let's impeach the president for lying, as Neil sang. That's an obvious political statement. But there was a fire in the music, and there was a conviction. I mean, you know, Neil was saying something, and a lot of people would turn him off for saying, I do not like Bush. I believe he lied. Mellencamp never says anything that anybody could object. I mean, look, who's going to say Jim Crow is good?
You know, the one thing that Mellencamp, I mean, I've never held him up to be a great lyricist, but he always had some detail in his lyric that kind of rang true. There was a resonance there that for all his kind of, you know, he was kind of like the bard of the daily grind. He didn't make any pretenses to poetry, but when he said, you know, sucking on a chili dog outside the Tasty Freeze in that dumb song Jack and Diane, he put a picture in your head and you kind of go, yeah, I can kind of relate to these two characters, you know, I can see that scene in my mind. But with these songs, I mean, he's just writing speeches.
Yeah.
And they're bad speeches.
Well, they're bad speeches. And look, you know, at least Neil Young, call him obvious if you want, but he suggested an action. Let's impeach the president for lying, right? Take action. Mellencamp, you know, it all builds to this song, Someday. Someday, but I don't know when. Someday, but I don't know when. Things will get better. Well, geez, you know, that's like a vision of the world that is about as sophisticated as a car commercial. If you buy this, your life will be better, which brings us right back to the top. I think as art, if we rate it on the sound opinion scale of buy it, burn it, trash it, this is a below, whatever would come below trash it, is it's so bad, this album,
well,
abysmally
it's too,
bad.
It's too bad because Mellencamp lets down his band. I do believe he has a very, very good band. Miriam Sturm, his violin player, is a terrific violin player in a rock and roll context. I've never seen anybody better. Terrific rhythm section. You know, a good scrappy garage rock band with big production values, albeit, but nonetheless a really tight-sounding rock and roll band. They would be the pride of any bar band in the Midwest, and I say that with all due respect. But Mellencamp's let him down. A terrible, terribly written album. For a guy who prides himself on being such a great songwriter, this is really one of the worst albums of his career, and it's a trash it.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we've got our rock doctors in the house, and we're going to be talking about the Shins a little later on. Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. The rock doctors are in the house.
Yes, we here at Sound Opinions, we understand how difficult it is to be a music lover these days. There's a bewildering array of musical choices out there. That's where we come in. We put on the stethoscopes, we prescribe some new music for you. Here's our next patient.
All right, we're going to talk to Rachel Gilman. She's 25. She's from Chicago. She is in need of some musical medical advice. Is that right, Rachel?
Unfortunately, it's true.
All right, so what's your story? How come you are out of – I mean, 25? Man, how come you're out of touch with what's going on in music?
It's embarrassing. I acknowledge this. I'm a huge movie person. I love TV. I'm an entertainment junkie, but music is my downfall. It's not that I don't like it. I'm just never proactive about it. So I've never bought something on iTunes, even though I have an iPod. I think the last CD I bought was in college. I listen to things that people give me. I listen to the radio, but I just – I'm absolutely in a rut.
It's so easy now. You know, you just click on and the music comes floating over the net.
Well, it's bewildering, though. I mean, there are so many choices that sometimes it can get intimidating, right? I mean,
thank you. I'm the victim.
How do you weed through all that stuff that's out there? And that's what we're here for, Rachel. And that's
what
we do.
You listen to Sound Opinions every week, and you see what we're talking about. If both of us like it, then Lord knows everybody else probably will.
Well, I saw that you guys talked to Roger Ebert, and I thought that was really cool. But I was unsuccessfully able to download it, so that just shows how much I do.
Oh, okay. Well, we can get you some technical help, but this is a deeper problem. Now, when you were last actively loving and buying music that you found yourself, what were your symptoms? What were the things that you loved?
I mean, this may sound ridiculous, but it's important for me to understand the words. I feel like with so much of the music that's out there, I'll like the sound of it, but I can't actually understand the lyrics if they're not enunciating or whatever it may be.
Okay. All right. But you also like a certain amount of heartland rock, right?
Would you classify Tom Petty's heartland rock?
Absolutely. I think he's the epitome of that. He's an all-American boy. Oh, yeah.
I love Tom Petty.
Sings about all American girls.
A lot of my music tastes stem from going to high school in a suburb of St. Paul and having friends that were really into certain bands, and then I just kind of glommed onto that and got used to it. It's like the soundtrack to my high school years has never exactly ended.
Mm-hmm.
So I still love Tom Petty. I love U2.
All right, now when you say you loved U2, there's the early anthemic Irish U2, you know, there's the once Brian Eno came on board, Joshua Tree U2 starting to get arty. Which U2?
I would say earlier. Mm-hmm. I really love Joshua Tree. I love the best of CD they put together. That's like 1980 to maybe 1992.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the one that came out. What is the last one that came out?
How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb?
Yes.
So what I'm hearing, patient Rachel, is you like melodies, you like lyrics that are understandable, clear, anthemic maybe. Something that you can sing along with if only in your head. Maybe you like to sing out loud in the house.
I have an abysmal singing voice. Nobody hears it.
That never stopped any of us. Have you ever heard Jim?
My music teacher told me to play the Erasers.
I think there's a little bit of lighter in the air quality there because, you know, the anthemic and then the Petty. I mean, you know, right? Jerry Maguire, you know, banging on the dashboard to Free Fallin'. I mean, that's what you want, that rousing.
Yeah, before Tom Cruise's major public downfall, I really did enjoy that scene.
So the song, the melody, lyric are important. You want to hear those kind of things in the music that you want to discover today.
Yes.
I think I have a prescription suggestion, Dr. Codd, or do you want to go first?
No, go right ahead, Dr. DeRogatis. I think you should give the first prescription to Rachel.
I'm going to go, you know, I tend to go to the more experimental treatments. Dr. Codd tends to stick with the tried and true, you know, take a couple of aspirin. I'm going to seize on.
You know, I can't let that pass. I mean, what? What meds are you on right now, my man?
Well, usually.
Okay, all right. All
one
right.
of our last patients said she liked Ella Fitzgerald.
Rachel, you and I are going to prescribe something for Jim.
La Ultra.
I think that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all right. I'm going to combine two things you like here. Joshua Tree being one of your favorite U2 albums, that's when Brian Eno came in and started to bring some of that sweeping kind of electronic ambience to the background of what they'd been doing. The Heartland Rock, you know, Tom Petty's great. And he put out a great album last year. I'd say go out and buy him. But I want to combine an act that brings together that Heartland Rock and that serious, you know, post-Bob Dylan flair for lyrics with the experimentalism of Brian Eno era U2. And I think if you haven't heard Wilco, or if you've only heard them in passing, you need
only
to really
passing.
All right, you need to really immerse yourself in a Wilco album. And we might as well go with the last one. They're gearing up to put out a new record this year, see, so maybe if this catches on, you can continue the treatment with their new album. But A Ghost Is Born came out about a year and a half ago. It was their fifth studio album, or their seventh if you count the two records that were Woody Guthrie tributes. But this is probably their most experimental albums, but still at the core, Jeff Tweedy is a heartland rocker. I mean, I think he falls in a line that includes Bob Dylan and Tom Petty and Neil Young. You know, he writes about the American condition, and all of his songs can essentially always be stripped down to an acoustic guitar and the words. There's a great melody there. There's always great words there. And then with the current version of Wilco that he has, he brings a lot of experimental guitar stuff, some keyboard textures, electronic backgrounds, the incredible drumming of Glenn Cochee, who was a guest on our show a couple of months ago. It might throw you at first, but you committed to immerse yourself in the treatment and listen to all these records a couple of times, at least give them a shot, and I think you'll hear the songs, but you'll also hear really a good representation of what kind of the cutting avant-garde edge of popular music is.
I appreciate that.
All right, so Wilco, A Ghost Is Born. What are you going to recommend there, Dr. Cott?
Well, Rachel, you mentioned the U2 fandom. Now, did you see any shows on the last U2 arena tour?
Yes, I saw the one in Chicago about a year ago, October.
Okay. So there's a very good chance, and I believe at those shows, right before they came on stage, they played a big anthemic song by another band. I don't know if you remember that, if you were aroused by it, but I was astounded by the reaction of the audience
to that
particular song. Everybody got out of their seats. Obviously, they knew the show was starting. But I thought the audience was responding to that song as well as to the entrance of U2 in a lot of ways, because the song definitely filled up the arena in a way that was kind of revelatory for me. That song was a song called Wake Up by a band called Arcade Fire. And it's a song on their first record called Funeral. Connected the dots for me. The 21st century version of what U2 was doing in the mid-80s is what Arcade Fire is doing. And they're not a band at the level of U2 yet in terms of playing to audience of that size.
No, and they're not
but
trying to feed Africa.
I think they definitely have the...
You yes. know, and they're not lunging with Desmond Tutu or
no,
any of that stuff.
And that's to their credit. They're just about the music. But I think if any new band has the potential to be a band of the stature of U2 in terms of being able to do those kind of big arena anthems, it's Arcade Fire. And, you know, when you listen to the Funeral record, go to that song, Wake Up, and see if you remember. Because to my mind, on that fall U2 tour, that was a big moment in those shows. It was actually some of the best music you heard all night, you know, and it wasn't by U2, it was by the Arcade Fire.
That's interesting that they played that to start off the show.
They're big fans, and Bowie's big fans, so they're definitely getting some notice from the big boys. And I think it's only a matter of time before this band's playing arenas, too.
All right.
So they can just get a song on a WB soundtrack, they're set.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah. Well, but they're indie rock. I don't know if they want to go that way, nor do I think Wilco will anytime soon. But Wilco and the Arcade Fire, and, you know, you take your medicine, Rachel, and we'll check back within a week and see if it's cured your ills.
Well, I appreciate the prescription. Thank you.
All right. You bet.
Thanks, Rachel.
Bye.
All right, it's time to check back in with our patient. We've issued a couple of prescriptions to Rachel to see if she could cure herself of her musical ills. Rachel, we want to know how the prescriptions work for you.
I think the prescription was fairly good. I'm feeling a little bit better, although I wouldn't say I'm 100% cured.
The musical malaise has not lifted entirely, but some encouragement? Symptoms are lessening?
Yeah, I'm on my way.
Okay. Why don't we take Greg's recommendation first? Greg, what did you prescribe?
I recommended the Arcade Fire Funeral, and kind of leading away from your U2 fixation, hoping to move you up into the 21st century with a record actually made in the last few years. Now, how did that work for you, Rachel?
I thought it was a very solid recommendation, and I have been listening to it since on my iPod. The thing that was really interesting to me is two of the songs I'd already had on my iPod, except they were from a mix that somebody gave me, and they weren't labeled by artist. So I was like, oh, wait, I already like these. This is good.
Oh, okay.
And so I listened to a few other ones, and as with me and all music, it takes a couple listens to be like, oh, yeah, this is good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rebellion song and Crown of Love were the two favorites.
So Dr. Cott was not off in his diagnosis.
No, he was pretty dead on.
Good.
And you hear the anthemic
thing. I feel
like
you two better, but that's not to say I won't grow with this band.
Right.
Okay. Mono, he has something.
Oh, yeah, that might not be musical, though. I don't know. Maybe the appeal is extra musical.
He's a humanitarian. He's sexy. He has a lot going for him.
You said the Arcade Fire worked for you. What was it that worked about it for you, and what didn't you like about it?
I feel like my interest in it was kind of inconsistent. There were some songs that grabbed me that I felt I really enjoyed listening to, and I liked the sound of it, and I wanted to hear it again and again. And some of them just sounded, some terrible maybe, but more like noise, and I just didn't respond to the music as much.
So there were some tracks on there that were a little more experimental. You would like the more straightforward anthemic stuff.
I think I do.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm kind of traditional that way.
And I think live, it's almost like a band that you have to see live to sort of experience what the album is about. Because I don't think I appreciated the album until I saw this band a couple of times live. And they just blow people away because they do have that big stadium-ready sound. And when you see it kind of in a theater, it really works. And I saw them in a couple of big festivals, and they just carried the crowd away with some of these bigger songs on that record.
And then you became a bigger fan after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So now you have to put that on your concert calendar. This band is going to be coming back this year, 2007, because they got a new album coming out in a few weeks. And if you get a chance to see them live, I think that's when it's really going to kick in for you.
Okay.
All right, and I tried to steer you toward Wilco, and it was a little bit more of a radical treatment. But, you know, I mean, let's face it, in that mid-era there where Joshua Tree is an album you love by U2, they started to experiment and do a lot of ambient things with Brian Eno producing them. You also like the Midwestern sound of Tom Petty, the real roots rock. And I tried to take a real Midwestern band, Wilco, that made an art rock Brian Eno kind of record, Ghost Is Born. Did I have any success there?
Again, I thought you were also fairly successful. I did like it. The Theologian song was the one I liked the best.
Yeah, Theologians.
Theologians, sorry.
Theologians, all that don't know nothing about my soul. Oh, they don't know. They fill my heart with little things, and my life will change. So many ways I find more missing every day.
Again, I discovered that I had a few of these on my iPod from way back and wasn't able to place them. And then in hearing them again, I'm like, oh, I do enjoy it. You can understand all the lyrics. It's very easy listening. They remind me, I feel like they're kind of clever in the way that Fish is clever. And if you're listening, you kind of pick up on some of their humor.
Wow. Clever in the way that Fish the jam band is clever.
Yes. And I could be making a total leap here, but just in listening to some of the lyrics, I thought they were amusing and interesting plays on words in the same way that I sometimes thought Fish did that.
Well, Theologians definitely has play on words, and Fish, you're right. I mean, Fish was probably the funniest, without a doubt, most tongue-in-cheek of all the jam bands. They did not take themselves too seriously, so there's something
to
say.
I can
see the connection.
You
Jim is sort of looking askance here, but I can understand what you're saying.
I'm actually stumped. Some medication, when you take it, causes dizziness, and you shouldn't drive.
There are side effects, yeah.
I don't know. All right, let me ask you about Wilco. Now, you're holding back, Rachel, because I'm guaranteed there's one song on this album that you hated.
You know what? I can't say that there's something I hated. I just I'm more the person that will find the thing I really like, and it'll be like one or two tracks, and I will listen to them excessively.
Even the last track, the 25-minute noise
second
jam?
Second to last track, actually.
I have to say that I didn't listen all the way through that one.
What's the name of that song?
The 15-minute one is Less Than You Think.
Yeah, that song, Less Than You Think, the noise jam, and then they give you this other song at the end of it, the late greats, is test to see if you made it through the noise jam.
And do you think, and I mean, I'm not the expert by any means, but it's a little indulgent to have a 15-minute track.
Yeah, that was a test to the fans. That was a little bit the band thumbing their nose, being artistes and saying, you know, let's see if you can take this. And then they give you the reward at the end. It's like you go to the doctors, they take your blood and all that stuff, and then they give you a lollipop.
Okay, so I'm in it for the lollipop.
The greatest lost track of all time. Late greats, turpentine. You can't hear it on the radio. You can't hear it anywhere you go. The best band will never get signed. Kiss that star and butcher's blind. So good you won't ever know. They never even played a show.
Where do we go from here? You know, the road to good health, Rachel, it rests on you.
With good intentions.
We can only do so much. I mean, you know, now you got two new albums. It's not going to become like, it's not going to add these to your collection of four, right? I mean, you're going to keep trying to dig a little?
I think I should. And I was actually wondering if you have any more recommendations that I
Oh, that's good. All right. Yeah, all right. That's what we want. So listen to the rest of the show. Go out and buy that Shins record. I would also tell you.
I like the Shins. What they did in, what is that movie? Garden State.
There you go.
When Dan Rabbit sing it, the song will change your life.
All right. Well, you listen to the rest of this show, and you'll get a sample of the Shins and our review of it.
Yeah. So, Rachel, now we're going to change your life, okay? So.
I really appreciate that. I want to be as healthy as possible.
Thank you for being such an eager patient, Rachel.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Next up, we've got reviews of new albums by The Shins and The Good, The Bad, and The Queen.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That's a song called Australia from the third album by The Shins, Wincing the Night Away. Power pop group from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I call them power pop. They've never been very powerful in the past. The third album, Wincing the Night Away, is a bit of a departure. Who are The Shins? Well, you might have just seen them on Saturday Night Live. You might know them from a car commercial, or most likely you know them from the film Garden State.
What are you listening to?
The Shins. You know them?
No.
You gotta hear this one song. It'll change your life, I swear.
Gold teeth and the curse for this town. Rolling my mouth.
This music will change your life. Natalie Portman was trying to convince her boyfriend, Zach Braff, the guy who directed that film. It did a tremendous amount to launch the Shins' career. And now they are recording album number 3, taking a little more time in the studio than ever before, adding another member. Eric Johnson used to be in the Fruit Bats. He's a great multi-instrumentalist pinch hitter, and going for a sort of sustained mood that wasn't necessarily there before. I mean, the Shins always had a stylized sound, but this time, I think quite consciously, Greg, we're making a studio record. We're going to hear something from this, and then we'll jump in with our opinions. Phantom Limb is a single. James Mercer, the guy who fronts the band, the singer, the songwriter, the kind of auteur of the Shins, he has said that this song, quote, is a hypothetical, fictional account of a young lesbian couple in high school dealing with the rotten small town they live in. I've listened to this song many times, and I'm very fond of it. I don't hear that. I do hear typically ornate lyrics from Mercer, who fancies himself quite the poet. Foals in winter coats, white girls of the north, file past 151. These are the fabled lambs of Sunday hams. This is the sort of thing you get from Mercer, who clearly comes from a tradition, I think, that's more British than American, of very literary, witty lyrics. The British press love him. In fact, my favorite British review of this new album compares him to the Woody Allen of indie, literate, self-deprecating, and witty. I don't know about all that. We'll give our opinions shortly, but this is Phantom Limb by the Shins from album number 3, Wincing the Night Away on Sound Opinions.
Frozen into cars, white girls of the north, file past 151. They are the fabled lambs of Sunday Ham, the HS Norm, and they could float.
Phantom Limb from the Shins, and I do swoon when I hear those wordless vocal harmonies in that song every time.
Oh,
it gets me every time.
Right about 220, exactly the right point in a pop song where you kick it up to the higher level. That's killer when they get to that.
That's a wonderful song, and one of the best tracks from the new album by the Shins, Wincing the Night Away, third album. And as Jim said, this group has sort of been building to this moment, all eyes on them. And the first two albums were sort of ignored until that Garden State movie came out. And now they are the indie rock buzz band of the moment. How are they doing in that moment? Well, the budget has increased. This is a much lusher record. Joe Ciccarelli, a veteran producer, has been brought in to help produce the record. He's been worked with people like Beck and U2. This guy knows big budget productions. And you can hear it. I mean, there's definitely a sense of plushness about this album that did not occur on the first two records. But they haven't become more obvious. In fact, this is the strangest Shins album yet.
Oh, yeah.
This Jim had mentioned that James Mercer is not the most direct lyricist in the world, but the arrangements have become more convoluted, more complex, more texture, less bottom-heavy, less about, you know, directing this pop sound straight into your head and drilling it in with repetition. This is a record that demands to be listened to over time, many listens absorbing the world that they throw you into, and they are sort of throwing you into the deep end. I think the band sort of feels like it's in the deep end of the pool or the ocean right now with all this water imagery in the songs. You know,
it's girls, a soggy record, yeah.
Yes, a lot of sea legs and black wave and girl sailor. There's a sense of someone, the characters in these songs, venturing into the unknown, and the record sort of sounds like that, very mysterious, very textured, and it's about those plush, beautiful melodies that sort of creep up at you rather than grab you by the throat. I do love this record quite a bit, but it's a subtle record. It's not the record you would expect from a band that suddenly has the world's attention upon it. You would expect them to be a little bit more direct and let's craft that radio pop hit. Instead, they have made their most artful and textured and strange record.
Well, that's what I like about it, Greg. I had a problem with the Shins. You and I had one of our most memorable fights somewhere around number 700 or 800 on the list about the Shins. I think about Shoots Too Narrow, the last album,
which I loved, top 10 for me in 2003.
I didn't like the Shins. I mean, I like power pop, and I think the best power pop bands, you know, groups like the DBs or Big Star, where it all came from, took the original British Invasion sounds of the Beatles and the Birds and brought it somewhere new, and there was always this sort of exuberance. The Shins were getting by on this sort of wimpy twee end of things. They were a little too delicate, a little too much finesse and filigree and not a, come on, guys, jump up and down and celebrate. They're not doing that here necessarily. It's still the same Shins, but what they've brought in, and I know, I get penalized. You know, James Brown used to fine people in the band if they dropped a note. I get penalized by the Sound Opinions producers every time I mention the name Brian Eno. But there is,
ding.
Brian Eno continues to be a huge influence on much of what we hear in popular music today. I was talking about what he did with U2 earlier in the Rock Doctor segment, you know, for the Joshua Tree. Here, I think that quite consciously, the Shins are referencing another soggy album, Eno's first solo album, Here Come the Warm Jets, this sort of record that has this incredible lush production. Everything is upside down, inside out. Hooks come from unexpected directions. A little vibraphone thing here or some sleigh bells there.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that interesting. Finally, the Shins have added the extra ingredient that make them live up to some semblance of the hype in my book.
Unexpected moments in this record. Just listen to, there's a moment in the song Red Rabbits where you think there should be a guitar solo. This is kind of a guitar-based band. Instead, there's this amazing sound. I think it's created by strings and maybe a pedal steel guitar. It's just kind of like about a 10-second swoon.
Yeah.
And it's one of those moments where the hair stand up on your neck and you go, I just want to hear that sound over and over again. And they just sort of insert it 3 minutes into this really elegantly crafted pop song.
Who decides who paddles over the falls? Yeah, who makes the call? Who makes the call. These
guys know what to do with a melody, and they know how to make it sound fresh and new.
I gotta say, on our patented Sound Opinions rating scale, buy it, burn it, trash it. This is a buy it record. It sucks me in more and more.
It's a double buy it from Jim and I.
Thank you.
you're a fan of the British pop band Blur or the Gorillaz, you might recognize that voice. That is Damon Albarn, the singer and songwriter in both of those bands. This is Albarn's latest project. He's teaming up with some other big names, including Clash, former Clash bassist Paul Simonon, former Verve guitarist Simon Tong, the brilliant Nigerian drummer Tony Allen, who used to play with Fela, handling the production, you know, another superstar.
Yeah.
Danger Mouse, DJ Danger Mouse, Brian Burton, a.k.a. So you have these five named talents pooling their resources on a record called The Good, The Bad, and The Queen. Apparently that's the name of the group as well. No indication whether or not this group is going to tour, no indication whether it's going to be follow-up albums, but for now, we have this one-off supergroup album. Here's another track from it. It's called Kingdom of Doom on Sound Opinions.
Kingdom of Doom from the self-titled album by The Good, The Bad, and The Queen. A rather silly name, but it comes from a lyric in one of the songs. Damon Albarn, Greg, I think, is one of the most creative forces in rock today. There was that silly, much-hyped war between Oasis and Blur at the height of the Britpop craze that followed the alternative explosion in America. For my money, Albarn was always leagues above. I mean, here's a guy who grew up. His dad was a road manager for some of the psychedelic progressive rock bands in England. He grew up backstage at Soft Machine shows, sitting there finger-painting. Albarn was born to British rock royalty, British art rock invention. And I think that since the demise of Blur, although they may be reuniting, a lot of rumors in the English press, he's consistently followed his muse in different directions. And here, putting together this supergroup, where, interestingly enough, with the exception of Simon Tong, who, you know, the Verve kind of musical settings kind of, I can see where that comes from. But everybody else is sort of doing something a little unexpected. The great drummer that you mentioned, Tony Allen, he's not doing the polyrhythmic African rhythms that he did with Fela Kuti. Paul Simonon is not doing punk rock. But let's not forget, The Clash also had a lot of experience with dub reggae. And that's kind of, so everybody's kind of doing something a little different. And Albarn is not doing the exuberant Britpop that a lot of people still associate with him. Certainly with Gorillaz, he did different things. Here, it's very low-key, very understated. It's a moody record. It's a dark record. Silly name would lead you to think that maybe this was going to be kind of a silly, upbeat band, but it's not. Instead, it's this kind of sustained mood piece that sucked me in. And really, I think there's a lot there. It's not a record you get on the first listen, like the Shins. You got to keep digging. And then when you do, there's some real surprises. Something like that 80s Life song where he's paying homage to 50s doo-wop. I mean, wow, that's fast. fascinating, and I'm really into this record, I got to tell you.
Well, unlike the Shins record, which I think rewards intensive listening because the melodies finally sweep right over you and grab you, there's nothing to grab onto here, Jim. This is, I think, a waste of a lot of talent. I think it's primarily a Damon Albarn and DJ Danger Mouse record. They didn't need those other guys. I'm not even sure that Tony Allen is even on this record until the last two or three tracks, where you can actually hear one of the great drummers in the last 40 years actually display some of his talent. Paul Simonon, I mean, they might as well have used a click track from an old Clash reissue. I mean, I cannot believe that the man who played bass on all those tracks, the man who was seen on the cover of London Calling smashing his bass into a stage, is even on this record.
You don't hear the bass that we heard during the freakier, trippier dub moments of Sandinista.
Of Sandinista, here? Exactly. And this
I hear that.
And one album of that, I mean, is way too much. I mean, the thing about Sandinista that worked is that it was interspersed with some up-tempo stuff. There was some punk in there. There were some different grooves throughout that album that made it a sprawling mess, but a beautiful mess. In fact, my favorite Clash record. But this record is essentially a one-note mood piece. Damon Albarn just sounds tired. He sounds like he needs a bowl of soup and somebody to tuck him in for a nap. I mean, come on, wake up, man. If you're so talented, give me something. I know he's sad about the war. We keep hearing it over and over again. The war's bumming me out, man. Okay, great. War sucks. We all know that. Tell me something I don't know. And more importantly, give me some music that I haven't heard before.
I think it sustains a mood. This is a mood album for, 3 in the morning. Kingdom of Doom is an appropriate title. There's a lot of talk of apocalypse and things on the edge. There's also this whole other strain, which apparently you missed because you didn't listen that closely, Mr. Cott. Simonon and Albarn live in the Portobello Road area of London. There are a lot of references to the multicultural backdrop there. It's increasingly less so. The world is gentrifying, even London. But the kind of all these cultures coming together and Muslims coming together with Christians, there's a lot of stuff like that. I think this is a buy it record. Yes, it's one note, but it's one brilliant note that carries you through this hour of music.
God. It's a great album. If ever I need a snooze, I might download some of these tracks, but as far as I'm concerned, it's a trash it record.
Oh, man. You're nuts. You're nuts. I love this record. What are you, anti-English all of a sudden or what? Albarn?
I'm anti-boring.
What do we got next week?
Next week we've got one of the finest hip-hop artists in the country, Lupe Fiasco, nominated for 3 Grammy Awards off his fine 2006 debut album, Lupe Fiasco's Food and Liquor.
It's going to be good stuff. As always, we got some thank yous to say, Greg. Sound Opinions is produced by Todd Bachman, Matt Spiegel, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn. Get some legal assistance from Dino Armiros, Jim Russell, and the folks at American Public Media. Put our name out there in the world. And Tori Southside Malatia is a man who needs no rock doctoring. He's doing just fine.
And no Brian Eno reference in the thank yous. Thank you so much, Jim.